Good afternoon, and welcome to Best of Health with your host, Arlie Helm. Today we will have two interviews. One interview with Sally B. Watkins, Change Your Mindset, Not Your Man. And the second, an interview with Dr. Dodds of the University of Vermont, Measuring the Happiness of Large-Scale Written Expression, Songs, Blogs, and Precedents. You are listening to KVMR FM 89.5, Nevada County, Nevada, California. Stay tuned. Good afternoon, and welcome to Best of Health on KVMR FM 89.5. This is Arlie Helm with Sally B. Watkins. Sally B. Watkins is a psychotherapist and life coach and author of a new book, Change Your Mindset, Not Your Man, Learn to Love What's Right Instead of Trying to Fix What's Wrong. Welcome to our show, Sally.
Thank you, Arlie. It's great to be here.
And I wanted to have you on the show because I'm thinking about happiness and doing a show on happiness. And one thing that I thought could contribute to happiness in a big way would be to help people look at their relationships and figure out how to make them better instead of looking at what's wrong with them and how to change the other person. It seems like to me a shorter path to happiness is to try to figure out how to be happy and not how to be right.
Exactly, because the only person you can change is yourself, really. And actually, we're each responsible for our own happiness. We can't put that on someone else and make them be responsible for fulfilling our lives and making us happy. That's kind of a crazy idea, really. And, you know, it's so embedded in our culture. We see it really everywhere from the time we're probably infants watching those Disney movies where you just find the right person and everything is wonderful.
And if everything's not wonderful, evidently you've got the wrong person.
And you've got to dump him and move on, yeah, and find the right person so that everything will be wonderful. People don't really get it that relationships take work because we never see this in movies or romance novels or anywhere in our culture. We don't see that all relationships take a certain amount of work and actually work on ourselves. It's a process.
And if you leave that relationship, you'll take yourself to the next relationship, and there's your work still right there in front of you.
That's great. That's a great concept. Yes, it's so true. And if it's not right there because we haven't changed, we can help to create that. We can do the same things we did in the previous relationship and get this person to be like the one we left. So you're right. Our work is always there.
So how do you stop? How do you get yourself out of that cycle of just complaining and blaming and trying to do some kind of analysis on your partner and figure out what's wrong with them and how they could be better?
Well, I think the whole idea is that these are things that come up because these are things that you need to look at in yourself and you need to do something about. So my book is full of ideas for people. One is to look at your early life wounding because a lot of times we're looking to a partner to make up for what we didn't get as a child growing up. If we didn't get a lot of attention or affection or our parents were distracted or not available or gone. So sometimes when we realize that that's what we're trying to do, we're trying to get this person to care for us in a way that we weren't as a child, that can be very freeing, where we realize that a romantic partner is never going to make up for what we didn't get growing up, that we've got to just grieve the past and start to do our own self-care, kind of, you know, be our own mentor for that child. I know the inner child has kind of been overworked, but there is a part of us that needs our grown-up, resourceful self to help that person when those fears and anxieties and those longings and that pain comes up because the environment, whatever it is, isn't giving us what we really want.
And at the same time, your book, you know, really is geared toward women. It's got this bright pink color, and it says, change your mindset, not your man. But at the same time, if a woman is in a relationship with a man and feeling that she wants to get her unmet needs finally fulfilled, is he doing the same thing?
Yeah, he could be doing the same thing. And, you know, my original book was a gender-neutral book. So I presented these ideas that could work for any kind of relationship. It didn't matter what the gender of those people were. But the publisher, of course, they're interested in money, of course, making money. And since women, by most of the self-help books, they did want it targeted to women. But these ideas work either way, really. And I think men, their reaction is probably different when they don't get their needs met. Men tend to withdraw or give up or get distracted in other activities and so forth. Women, on the other hand, tend to complain or bring these problems more to the fore. So their reaction is somewhat different, but yeah, they both have some erroneous ideas about what a relationship is for, what it will do for them.
So really, anyone could pick up this book and start going through this. So let's look at this. Let's one of the exercises, or I don't know if you'd call them exercises, but one of the steps that you have, try this.
Mm-hmm.
Unhook from your thoughts, where you suggest that someone identify, I am having the feeling of, or I'm having the thought of.
Mm-hmm.
So it's separate from just I am.
Exactly. And this is, you know, part of the larger idea that our thoughts are very powerful in controlling our moods, our behaviors, and can affect us very deeply in lots of ways. And we create our own reality by thinking of things and obsessing about things. They magnify. We tune out some of the other more positive things, kind of obsessing about certain things. So we've seen a lot of these are wisdom principles that have been around for centuries, but we've seen them again in the form of The Secret, the DVD, and the book, and The Law of Attraction with Esther Hicks. Have kind of made them new again. And, of course, this is the tenet of cognitive behavioral therapy that's been around for 20 or 30 years and very well researched, that our thoughts are so powerful. And so when we think a thought and we believe it, then it colors everything. And so what I'm saying in this exercise is detach from that thought. Look at that thought as I'm having the thought or I'm having the feeling, rather than joining with it and assuming that that is a truth about you or about something that's happening. And that way we can sort of dissociate from these thoughts and look at them a little more critically and challenge them, especially when they are downers and making us depressed or anxious or upset.
Give us an example of someone first, like, thinking this is the truth and then separating themselves a little bit and looking at it more critically.
You know, a lot of women will come to therapy in my practice when sort of the honeymoon has worn off and they're not getting that euphoria and that excitement and that chemistry, and kind of life is going on in this ordinary way and reality is setting in, and they're feeling really upset that their partner isn't maybe looking like he's as attracted to them or as into them and so forth. And she's feeling confused about whether she made a good choice or whether this is the man for her or whether, you know, if she's doing something wrong and so forth. So there's a lot of that kind of confusion. So when she looks at those thoughts and dissociates somewhat from those thoughts and realizes that maybe there's other ways of looking at this situation, maybe there's a different view that she could take. And so brainstorming some of the other views, like, well, maybe that kind of euphoria and excitement can't last. And maybe learning to be in the kind of an everyday reality is a good thing. And maybe there's other benefits to relaxing and being more comfortable with each other and learning how to accept that this is the way things are going to be. So it's a way of not immediately thinking this is the truth, this is what's happening, but kind of exploring lots of other beliefs.
And also when you do that, when you stop and think there's other beliefs, you realize that you don't know what it's like to be your partner. Mm-hmm. And they've got beliefs as well. Mm-hmm. So what you think is the truth is just your point of view, and it's not the whole story.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think women don't understand always how men are socialized so differently from them. When you bring it to their attention, they start to realize that that's true, but I think normally they don't think about how boys are at least... years ago, and maybe that's changing somewhat now, but they're told to stuff their feelings and don't be a sis, and they're not allowed to cry or be upset. Men are not even genetically wired the same way. We're finding out with this new brain research that men's centers for communication and emotions in their brain is much smaller than women. So when we look at how men are genetically built and how they're socialized, we can see that they're not looking at relationship as the center of their life. They're not seeing that this is a reflection of who they are. They're much more looking to the greater world to define them and to see them as successful. So when we see the differences, then we have to say, you know, what is going on with him? Rather than just seeing it through my eyes and through my needs.
There's a piece of that that's, it seems to me, compassion comes in a lot there. And I don't know whether, I mean, you talked about empathy, so let's talk about empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Being empathetic or being compassionate with your partner. First, as you said, realizing that what seems to be just the universal truth is actually, from your point of view, some pieces of the truth. I'm feeling this, or mm-hmm. I'm needing that, but it's not the whole entire truth. So how do you to pull in some more parts, to be more empathetic and more compassionate with your partner? How do you pull that in?
You know, I think that's comes from, you know, the whole idea that you're learning how to accept and how to be with someone the way they are and how to support that person's growth and evolution, even if it doesn't always meet your needs and even if it isn't always in the direction that you want, that this is really kind of the basis for real love, is to support someone's being in the world in a truest sense, rather than just supporting their being the way you want them to be. So I think when you come from that part, the idea is that you want to learn about this person. You want to understand them better. You want to see what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what's important to them. And I think that's the basis for empathy, where we start to be open to hearing exactly what's going on with them, even if it isn't what we always want to hear.
And maybe even if it isn't set in the same kind of words that we would use.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems like part of this is as you said, if we're socialized different growing up, we're going to frame it different. We're going to use different words because we're looking at it from a different point of view.
Yes. And we experienced our lives differently. And I think that's some of the things that men will talk about if there's acceptance and openness to that, I think, because men are very sensitive to criticism and want to protect themselves from criticism. They're often not forthcoming with how they really think or feel. But when there's a climate like this of acceptance and really support for them, and their feelings, I think women are surprised how much a man will reveal.
nothing that you've ever read in any of your research indicates to you that men have less feeling than women, has it?
No. I think men have a harder time accessing their feelings. But men do have a lot of feelings. And as men age, the research shows that they tend to be more open with their feelings, so that you'll have older men being more able to express some painful or deeper feelings. Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That's also sort of a motivation for working things out and keeping the guy a long time, because you realize that you and he are both going to change, and maybe you're both going to change for the better.
Exactly. I think if it's a good relationship and you support each other that way, a relationship really, really is a good teacher and shows you how to grow and what you need to learn and inspires you to this truly loving, accepting place. It can be a hugely spiritual evolution for partners.
So what's the first step? How do we get unstuck from this sort of position of feeling that we're one down and we're just feeling bitter about the where we are stuck?
Well, I think that, again, is a thought process that needs to be untangled. The book is set up to kind of work through from those beginning elements where you start to untangle those thoughts and start to rework those thoughts and look at your stories and what's the story that you're telling about your partner and even about yourself and about your relationship, and maybe even sharing this story with your friends and your mother, heaven forbid. And as the more you relate this story and gather evidence and test your guy to see if he really loves you and so forth, all of this keeps building a case, and oftentimes not a very good case either. So I think it's good to really look at what's this narrative that you're building and weaving here.
So we can actually get ourselves in the position, the sort of self-defeating position of building a case against our own relationship.
Exactly, and then you wonder why you don't feel close, why you don't feel romantic, why this guy doesn't look attractive to you, why you're not turned on to him. And the reason, of course, is because you just came from lunch with your girlfriend where you told her all kinds of personal things about him that you can't stand.
And you're living in that moment. You're reviewing all the very good reasons that seemed to you at the time that this person is just not good enough for you.
Right. And women do a lot of testing. Men don't really do testing as much as women do, but testing is where you want him to choose you over something else. So you'll say to him, oh, you know, go with your buddies to the football game or whatever. I'll stay home and clean out the refrigerator or whatever. But then when he does that, then you're feeling resentful. You're saying, he doesn't want to be with me. He failed the test.
And from his point of view, that would be a trick. That would be dishonest.
Yes. In other words, he would, especially if he came home and you were now in your drama pouting and he says, what's wrong? And you say, nothing. And then he realizes that something's wrong and that it may come out then that he chose his buddies over you, and now you're going to punish him. So, you know, that's kind of the testing behavior that really is hard on guys and hard on the women who do it.
Sort of like bouncing on a step before you put all your weight on it. You sort of put your foot there and bounce it and test it to see if it's going to break.
Yes, exactly.
Is that because women are by nature brought up to be more cautious and be more concerned about making mistakes?
Yes, and you know, it's really it goes clear back to caveman days. Really, it was dangerous for women to be alone. It was dangerous not to be protected and taken care of by a big strong man. You know, she could bear children. and be alone. She needed a lot of support through that process. And so, you know, it's very deep. Women, this is sort of the basis for them to feel confident and to feel sure of their relationship, that he really loves her, is going to stick with her and stick by her. Studies showed that this is more important even than finances, that women can get through even bad finances if they trust that their guy really loves them and is going to stick with them. But this is very basic to a woman's nature.
And I'm guessing that this is that a man would feel more threatened by financial adversity,
mm-hmm.
thinking the main, you know, financial adversity is looming in the immediate future. He's going to feel like, well, the most important thing is to, you know, whip that, get that, get things set up financially, so that things are going to work out, and be more threatened and fearful about financial adversity.
Definitely, because that's his measure of success in the greater world. Men, of course, use money as a way of showing their success and their prowess and their power.
And so you've got people coming from two different points of general, not even a point of view, but a feeling that survival is all about X, or survival is all about Y, and the other stuff's not as important, but X and Y are two different things. So this woman, she's going to just accept that the man is different from her, or if it's a same-sex couple, that the partner is different from her. Once she's accepted that, as difficult as a first step, I say that as if it's an easy first step, and I realize it's not.
Mm-hmm.
But once she does that, what's step number two?
Well, I think then some of the other aspects that I bring out in the book were when you accept that, then you really want to get to know this person. You really want to have that trusting, open, honest communication style, where there's nothing that you can't reveal or say, because you feel that this person's going to be there supporting and allowing and being okay with who you are and how you are and so forth. So I think that's the, you know, the highest relationship standard, really, is to really have a very deep trust for each other, that you're going to support each other. It's so different. It's such a complete opposite from codependency, which is very prevalent, of course, in our culture. Codependency saying, I only want you to be what I want you to be, and if you're going to change, I don't want the change to be negative for me. And so people in a codependent situation will try to prevent each other from growing or changing, especially if it doesn't benefit them. Just the opposite in this trusting, loving, supportive, higher calling, where people can be much more allowing. And the reason they can be allowing is because, remember, they've done the work on themselves, where they have a deep resourcefulness internally, where they have a very internalized, strong sense of themselves. So that no matter what happens in the world or with this partner, they're going to be okay because they've done their own work. They're not emotionally dependent on this person being a certain way.
So they're emotionally close to, but not dependent on them being a certain way.
Right. In other words, each of us in this stronger, more positive relationship is going to use the relationship to grow and evolve and to learn and develop ourselves. And so we're not so needy for someone to be there for us. I point that out in later chapters, too, that women can develop more self-support and not expect that their partner is going to be the go-to person for all their emotional travails, so that they're not like a baby, in the sense that a baby can cry and needs a parent to figure out what's wrong and fix it, they're this evolved, resourceful adult who can negotiate for their own needs, who can ask for what they want, who can supply a lot of their own self-support.
And in fact, that makes sense to go back to look at all the different areas of your life and find out what your resources are in each of those areas instead of bringing all the pain home and handing it to your husband and, you know, saying, you know, fix this.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I also think that men can be prepared better by women to receive emotional things because men don't normally do this with each other, or where they would, some men will, but many men would not reveal a lot of emotional feelings to someone else. And so when a woman does this for a man without any preparation, I think he's not aware of what she needs or why she's doing this, or she wants advice or wants him to fix it, or, you know, needs something from him. So I think it's good for women to prepare men for what they want. I just need you to listen. I just need you to hold me. I just need you to hear this. I don't need you to fix it. You know, and that will make it more likely that he can be there for her.
You are listening to Best of Health on KVMR FM, Nevada City, an interview with Sally B. Watkins recorded earlier. And we're going to return to Sally B. Watkins. And after we hear Sally B. Watkins, we're going to be talking with Professor Danforth from University of Vermont. Because men are fixers, aren't they?
They are, yeah.
And if you bring what looks like a problem that's causing you a lot of pain, mm-hmm. and just hand it to him, the first thing he'll do is look for the fix.
Exactly, yeah.
And that might not be really what you're seeking at that time.
That's right, that's right. So I think women can do more of this. A lot of women think that if a man thinks something up on his own, if he figures out what's the perfect gift or what her special song or special days or what special sensitive things he can do that would please her and so forth, that this means a higher degree of love to her, that if she would ask for those things or hint at those things or tell him what she needs or tell him what she wants. But I find that women are a mystery to some men, to many men, and that they're eager to please her if they knew how, if they got some input from her about what that would look like. They're very eager to be there for her. So I think it's a mistake women make to think that he's got to figure this out for it to be right.
That it doesn't count unless he figured it out all on his own with no hints.
That's right.
So a relationship that's really working is actually helping both parties. I mean, as they're growing and they're sort of taking themselves through getting those resources and through that growth, would you say that it's in a positive relationship where there's trust and where there's positive feelings, that actually makes it easier to grow together?
Yes, and you know, it doesn't even take both partners, and that's another reason I wrote the book, because some of the other fix-it books by even big-name authors out there that have a lot of copies in circulation takes both people who agree to do the activities or work on the problems or whatever, and my book does not. I think that I get a lot of email from women who have done many of these things that I'm recommending and find that their relationship will change as a result of their doing these things. I show how women, because they are socialized and more relational in many ways, they can lead by example. They can do these things, and men will pick up on it or respond positively to it, and things can evolve even if he never reads the book and doesn't actually figure out these things on his own. And that's how the relationship changes, because she changes. You can see how that works. If one partner in the relationship changes, the other partner almost has to change in relation to that. You know, it's hard for the other partner to stay the same if she changes in this new and positive way. Of course, I do warn women who evolve and get more active in their own lives and create more happiness and excitement for themselves and in ways that are outside the relationship, which I think is important. Some partners who are very insecure would not relate well to this and would not perhaps want to stay with a partner who's growing in those ways. So there is a risk. There's a risk when you change. If you have a very fragile partner, he may not go along with that.
So that's something that a woman would have to decide for herself. Is being happier worth the risk of possibly losing this relationship?
And that's where I say it's good for people who are on the fence, who are saying, is this good enough to stay or is it bad enough to leave? I show them that if they do these changes and he can't accept that or is too fragile or too unable to expand his view and understanding and acceptance of her, then that's good information for her. She gets the information that she needs, that this isn't going to work for her.
That's a risk, that you take a risk when you change, that the relationship, you may actually grow farther apart instead of closer together. But assuming that both partners are, you know, within normal parameters of being healthy people and have at some time expressed love for each other, feel that they still love each other, what would prevent someone from trying these things?
Nothing. No, it's a good thing. In fact, men are oftentimes very excited when their partner expands her life and goes back to school or gets a job or starts a business or loses weight or does any number of things that make her feel good about herself and rev up her life and help her to find her own dreams and her own passion. Men find this extremely exciting and find her now kind of a new woman in the house, and a lot of renewal energy a lot of times happens in that situation. Building your life around just being the support person and taking care of people and earning love by doing favors for people and keeping yourself kind of stuck in that rut, I think is certainly not healthy. And I think women a lot of times do a lot of that when they're maybe stay-at-home moms, they have young children, and it requires a lot of them and so forth. And so not every time in a woman's life are these options available, but I think it's good for her to conceptualize her life as more than just caring for others.
Does it seem to you that more relationships could be improved and saved than are happening right now?
Oh, definitely. Oh, definitely. I think there's an enormous number of people who look outside their relationship for what's missing, having affairs, having fantasies that this isn't the right person and they need to move on and so forth. So I think a lot of times people don't want to do their own work to grow that would enable them to love this normally flawed person. You know, everybody's normally flawed in some ways. And so rather than seeking this perfection, we learn to make peace with this normally flawed person we're with by seeing the growth opportunities for ourselves.
That's wonderful. We've been talking with Sally B. Watkins. She is a life coach and a psychotherapist and author of Change Your Mindset, Not Your Man. Learn to love what's right instead of trying to fix what's wrong. Sally, why don't you give us a last thought after that?
Well, people who want to can go to my website at sallywatkins.net and read the first chapter online. And they can see some really lovely endorsements from some spiritual writers, David Rico, Molly Young Brown, Beverly Engel. So I think my website gives a lot of information, a lot of free information for people who want to check that out. SallyWatkins.net.
And that's WATKINS, SallyWatkins.net.
Yes.
Thank you very much for being on the show and talking to the KVMR listeners and giving some people some hope for improving their relationship.
Well, thank you, Arlie. It's been a wonderful time.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was an interview with Sally B. Watkins, life coach and psychotherapist, addressing the topic of couples who, where both are basically normally flawed and mentally healthy, and how in a people in those relationships can improve their happiness. And in future shows, we'll explore the more difficult topic of when one partner is perhaps not healthy and how to identify that and what to do. So we have on the phone today Dr. Christopher Danforth, who is an assistant professor at the Department of Mathematics and Statistics from the University of Vermont. Welcome to KVMR.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
It's great to have you on. Thank you for giving us time, because I ran into your article on the web and I thought, wow, what a great paper, Measuring the Happiness of Large-Scale Written Expressions, Songs, Blogs, and Presidents. But the more I read it, the more I thought, I could spend hours asking you about this. This really goes deep, and I've got all kinds of questions for you.
Great.
But let's start right off with having you explain generally what this was. What kind of a study was this?
Sure. So I am a mathematician who tries to make sense out of data. And what we did was try and collect some feelings from the web. There are lots of people communicating with each other, their friends and their family, via blogs and status updates on Facebook and Twitter, and so we went and coupled with some folks who were building a website called wefeelfine.org, and what they do is they write a program to crawl through all of the blogs being written in the world every 10 minutes and find expressions like I feel or I am feeling, any sentence that matches that pattern, and when it finds it, the computer finds it, it downloads that feeling along with any demographic information available about who wrote it, maybe their age or sex or latitude and longitude on the Earth. And then what we did was take all of those human feelings, we have roughly 10 million of them from more than 2 million people over the last few years, and we basically counted how many happy or sad words there were. We have a way of measuring the happiness of particular words based on psychology studies that have been done in the past. And so a word like triumphant would get a happy score, and a word like depressed would get a sad score. And so we add those things up and then look for patterns.
So you weren't invading anyone's privacy. They're putting themselves out there. You're just observing. You're just observing without interfering with them in any way. There's no possibility that you would skew the outcome because you're not asking them questions.
Yeah, most of the research that has been done on well-being involves surveys where people are asked the question, how are you feeling? And, you know, many things go through our heads when we hear that question. We try and decide, you know, what does this person want from me? And one of the nice things about the algorithm that we're building is that it doesn't ask that question of people. It's we're trying to just observe them in as natural an environment as possible at this scale.
Now, I have a lot of questions about culture, but one of them is, in my culture, people often say, I feel, when they really mean, I think. Was that a problem for you?
Yeah, so we started with this looking simply at sentences that have I feel in them. And I think, in general, we're just looking for the expression of emotion. And so since then, we've moved on to looking at messages from Twitter. And in that case, we're looking at every message that is public, not just the ones that have the words I feel in them. So we're looking beyond that expression now.
And I don't know if you caught the BBC headline news today, but apparently someone hacked into Twitter in Great Britain, and millions of people had verbal sexual assault through their Twitter link. So I imagine if you were doing that study right now, you'd be taking a big hit, and it might be really specific to some that incident on Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are, you know, in any situation where you're counting words that people are using, if there's a big spike because 5 million nasty sentiments were expressed by a single person, that's something that we would pick up and be aware of.
Would you throw that out as an outlier?
It depends on the nature of it. I mean, some of these Twitter accounts are spam, and they're called robots that basically, you know, they're broadcasting to anyone who will take the advertisement. But you know, we try and filter those in a way that's fairly technical. But we do keep track of them. Yeah.
And here's my biggest question of all. And let's talk about, you gave an example in your paper that you used the lyrics to Michael Jackson's song Billie Jean. And this is a song that I never understood the words until Michael Jackson died, and I got interested and went on the website and read about his life and read about this song, which is a song about being stalked by someone who's either mentally ill or maybe there has some evil intention. And unfortunately, an innocent baby is born, and so he's singing from the point of view, and I understand this is autobiographical, of someone who is both being, frightened by the stalking, and also pointing out how sad this is that this child got pulled into this. But in your example, Billie Jean got a pretty high strength or valence.
Right.
So can you explain that?
Sure. So Billie Jean is an example of a song with, there's some layers to it, and you're saying, it took a while for you to understand what it means, and it would take a computer much longer to figure out what the intention of Michael Jackson was when he wrote that song. So, you know, the reason it gets a happy score in our in our rating is that it uses the word love and mother and baby, and these are happy words, and the context is largely ignored. So, you know, with respect to how accurate our measure is when we simply count words and, how many happy words we find, it certainly isn't accurate at the level of a song or even all of the words that Michael Jackson uses in all of his songs. It's more that the way we use this is to try and, say, take the temperature of the country, for example, and we'll need, rather than just a few hundred words or a few thousand, we'll need actually millions or billions of words expressed by people online before we're particularly comfortable with our findings about how people are feeling. So it's kind of like taking the temperature. If you just looked at a few molecules in the room, you wouldn't really be able to tell the temperature of the room. You need many of them bouncing off each other, and that's really what we're trying to build, is something that would be able to take in all the online communication that's public and use it to develop a gross national happiness index, if you will, of how people are doing.
So it's similar to doing an epidemiological study of people. You can't take one person and infer some kind of causation because one person had a certain experience. But if you take a million people and you see a really strong trend, then you can.
That's exactly right. And we have ways to try and make sure that we understand what effect our lack of context has on our measure. But you're absolutely right.
Well, here's my first culture question. You sample blogs from all over the world, and, I'm most familiar with my own culture, of course, and it makes a certain amount of sense that in my culture you might have someone make a sentence like, there's no good reason to live life without love, and get a high valence because you had good life and love and live.
Right.
Where, because they put the word no in there, it's actually the opposite. But over... generally, I would say, yeah, I totally agree. In my culture, if I see words like love and life and live, I feel positive about that. But does that hold true over cultures, or did you mostly sample similar cultures to United States?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the majority of the people using English on Twitter are using it from the United States. So the majority of the people we have data on, they live here. So we don't have other languages that we're looking at this point. It's something we'd like to move to, but certainly the idea of using a computer to understand how someone is feeling, that's kind of a wild idea, and it's not the technology is not good enough at this point for you to even be able to call up, your local cell phone company and have their automated response figure out what it is you want if you speak freely. I mean, computers are very bad at that, just like they're bad at identifying what's in a particular picture. If you ask Google for pictures of a fire hose, you'll get lots of pictures of fire hoses, but a bunch that don't have fire hoses, because computers are bad at identifying what's in an image. We need people to be involved, and that's why we're hoping that this is one way to involve people is to have humans score words and decide, all over the country we'd like to have an experiment where people tell us how they feel when they read these particular words, and we'll get your culture and the culture in northern Maine and in southern Florida and all of them represented. And then when we get tweets, for example, from Northern Maine, we'll use the inference that we get from the people who've scored words from Maine in order to decide how happy that status update is.
That's brilliant because, you know, I do think around the country people use language differently. People might be more, perhaps more cynical in one area or speak in adopt a cynical posture when they're talking. And and someone from another area, even in the same country, might be able to figure out if they're human, but in a computer, not so much.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, one of the things we'll do is we look at, you know, the differences between states, for example, because we know where these messages come from. And we find in California, people use the word beach a lot and the word love, and they don't use the word cold as much as people do everywhere else in the country. And so, you know, that makes California one of the happier states. And you're not going to believe this coming from Vermont, but I'm a professor at the University of Vermont, and I will tell you that the happiest state in the country with respect to tweets and our measure is Vermont. And it's because we use the word hate a lot less than the rest of the country does. And so we can look at regions and see, you know, what words contribute to our score being higher or lower in particular parts of the world.
I'm glad you brought up the word hate because I looked at some of your words when you were talking about the ages of people tweeting, and you compared 14-year-olds to people in my age range, and you saw that people in my age range use the word hate less often. So are the people tweeting in Vermont older?
You know, certainly the demographics of people using Twitter are shifted towards sort of 30-somethings. And LinkedIn people tend to be in their early 40s and Facebook users in their 20s. But, you know, people blogging sort of go throughout this entire spectrum. And, you know, one of the things we did was look at 14-year-olds and how their words compare with folks who were born in the 60s. And so 14-year-olds use words like sad, stupid, hate, depressed, bored, lonely, alone. They use these words a lot more frequently than folks who have more experience in their life and can take the bumps of the day a little bit more realistically. And so, you know, that certainly makes sense. And we see, as a function of age, we see that people tend to get happier from the beginning of their time blogging. They tend to get happier up until their health starts to fail. So we do see a rise and fall in happiness in over the 2 million people we were keeping track of.
So, you know, if a country had a population that was a huge younger population, it might be true that the country as a whole didn't have as high of a happiness index because they had so many inexperienced and volatile people in their population.
Yeah, and there are a lot of other reasons why young folks could be upset. I mean, they don't have enough money to make the decisions they might like to make. Maybe their parents won't let them go out. There are a variety of reasons why people who are teenagers are going through bigger bumps than as you get older, it's generally felt that your income and your flexibility and ability to travel should all go up, and so there are other reasons to expect that, but it is something that we see in sentences expressed by people online.
And you also looked at latitude, and you talked about seasonal affective disorder, but you've just identified Vermont, which is farther north than I am. We are here in Northern California, as being happier, tweeting happily, and so did you feel that seasonal affective disorder may have been a factor when you looked at the equatorial difference?
Yeah, so it's actually a similar trend that we see for age, that there's sort of a rise and fall as you leave the equator of the Earth in both directions, and so near the equator, the words that are used, lonely is a word that's used frequently near the equator, and obviously the economic situation there isn't quite what it is in mid-latitudes. In the northern hemisphere, you get a big spike. People who experience four seasons tend to be happier, it seems. And then in the northern latitudes, you see the word cold and tired and sleep and depressed a little bit more often than you do in the mid-latitudes.
That makes sense to me because, you know, where living physically is easy, it seems like you'd be less exhausted and be enjoying life more. I think that's why Southern California has become so overpopulated.
Mm.
Not that we're in Southern California here. We're broadcasting out of Northern California, but we do broadcast worldwide here on KVMR.
Right.
And I love what you said. Our results are sympathetic to recent work that finds happiness increases with income. Absolutely. Money does buy happiness. You know, if you can't pay for doctor visits and you can't pay for housing and you can't pay for food and you can't shelter your children, it's going to adversely affect your happiness.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. But, you know, there's a level of subsistence above which people need to be able to have in order to be happy. And that's seen across the board in many countries. But there's still an open question about this, because above that level of, you know, where you have shelter and the ability to take care of yourself and eat, that there doesn't appear to be a large effect using income. And certainly we saw the rolling over with age, but it is hard to see in most data, in most self-reported survey data, any effect beyond sort of once you get to the level of being able to take care of your family.
So I wonder if people that say happiness or money doesn't buy happiness, maybe they're far enough above subsistence level that it doesn't occur to them, but you don't
That's
have
right.
to have more money than God in order to be happy.
That's right. Absolutely.
And what was your male-female findings?
Right. So we had the happiness level between men and women was very similar. But we did find, and this is consistent with other studies, that women use the words at the ends of the spectrum far more frequently. The most emotive words, either happy or sad, women use them a lot more. And of the top 15 words that contribute to the difference between men and women, there's only one that men use more than women, and that's good, which is not surprising to any of us who come home at the end of the day and we get this, you know, how was your day question, and it's the first thing that comes to mind. My day was pretty good.
Yeah, I hear that, you know, most days of the year. So I had to laugh when I saw that. Yeah, good. Yeah, do you think
it conveys quite a bit?
Yeah,
Yeah,
but I guess women struggle to really capture the essence of the day.
I agree.
So thank you so much for coming on. I think this is fascinating. I think you're breaking new ground, and I'm going to follow you and see what new things you come up with.
Thanks, Arlene.
I think we need this.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. We've been talking with Christopher Dodd and Danforth, sorry. His co-author is Peter Sheridan Dodds. Christopher Danforth and Peter Sheridan Dodds are both professors at University of Vermont, doing some very interesting and groundbreaking work in happiness as part of statistical measuring and defining or describing, I guess, our culture and the culture of human beings. So I think my guests, Christopher Danforth and Sally B. Watkins, for coming on the air today. This has been Best of Health with your host, Arlie Helm, on KVMR 89.5 FM, Nevada City, California, heard worldwide on www.kvmr.org. Until next time, stay healthy. ¶¶